The following audio presentation is a rendition of a 2024 paper by Sarthik titled Chomsky's Approach to Philosophical Inquiry.
By Noam's approach to philosophical inquiry, I have in mind those metaphilosophical conceptual distinctions that appear very often in his technical work and play a crucial part in presentation, and I believe more so in his analysis. For Noam, like many analytic philosophers, there is no clear distinction between science and philosophy. Because philosophy has no independent domain of inquiry, where specific puzzles and problems can be solved by internally developed tools for gaining substantial understanding or insight. What is called philosophy nowadays is a second-order inquiry, i.e. more reflexive parts of to a largely natural sciences. This is distinct from what Katz called the traditional view of philosophy. Of, say, Thomas Nagel, who held that philosophy can tell us something about a priori truths. Further, Noam's naturalistic view of philosophy is methodological, that is, that the way for acquiring knowledge about the natural world is through method of scientific inquiry, naturalistic theory creation, not any set of procedures, but the social and intellectual. This is distinct from Quine's epistemic naturalism, which limits the acquisition of knowledge about the natural world through scientific means in the already existing categories of physical entities, primarily the entities of physics. Broadly, Noam's categorization of philosophical issues falls under three categories: 1. Common sense, 2. Theoretical problems, and 3. Pseudo-theoretical problems. Of the three, the third class of issues are mostly incomprehensible and not genuine issues in their existing form, and only fruitful and relevant inquiry can be either common sense or natural, scientific, and theoretic in nature. In this presented, I will first discuss what are common sense issues, followed by natural scientific issues, and then briefly talk about the third category. There are a set of issues in that revolve around confusion from how certain words are used. For example, what is it like to be a bat? Can computers think? Is water H2O? And many more. For Noam, like the Oxford linguistic philosophers, to understand what these words and phrases mean is to look at how they are used. Strawson, for example, noted that to refer is something people do, it is an act, and to understand how particular linguistic unit is used in action, we need to understand how we use them. We use the phrase is like a, among other things, to point to some resembling properties. We use think when talking about humans and maybe some animals, not organs like brain. So, there is a category of philosophical questions that are not real questions about natural world, but rise from the confused usage of phrases and terms. The internal meaning of these words and phrases, acquired in natural course of language acquisition and interaction with the outside world, have the following properties. 1. Are reasonably assumed to be innate in the Cartesian sense as dispositional. 2. Are anthropocentric, primarily human interest and action related. 3. Are rich and so far undefined, although in principle targets of the naturalistic theory of mind, including growth. 4. Are flexibly used in various ways and applied in metaphor, for example, in a diverse set of circumstances, invite creativity, appear to be domain general. And 5. Are constitutive of an understanding of our world, which is the world of everyday practical affairs. These are from James McGillivray's Chomsky volume. The problems about phrases and terms can be meaningfully asked when these are constructed within part of an explanatory framework, a scientific account and program. Hence, the way Putnam dealt with the problem of meaning is incomprehensible, because there is no explanatory framework where this term is used, but questions about Davidsonian semantics program can be asked more fruitfully and are a function of program's research and explanatory vitality. This leads us to the second class of issues. To understand this set of problems, let us recall that Noam is primarily a natural scientist, a researcher who is studying the properties of a mental organ within a biolinguistic framework. This fact, in light of his belief about the role of philosophy, tells us that Noam's primary concerns lies in this category of problems, which are the more reflective aspects of biolinguistic naturalistic inquiry. In these issues, most of his convictions are drawn from history of scientific practice and ideas. Noam follows Lakatos' framework and sees the practice of Kuhnian normal science as a competition and comparison of research programs. For most of his academic life, this has been a criticism of empiricist and behaviorist programs. but also structuralist and technology-based explanatory efforts. Lakatos notes that the basic unit of appraisal must be not an isolated theory or conjunction of theories, but rather a research program, with a conventionally accepted and thus by provisional decision irrefutable, hardcore, and with a positive heuristic which defines problems, outlines the construction of a belt of auxiliary hypotheses, foresees anomalies, and turns them victoriously into examples, all according to a preconceived plan. Lakatos' program comparisons bring Kuhn's evaluation phase of competing paradigmatic theories into normal science practice, based on the choice criterion which the initiated researcher acquires in the course of her training. She conducts rational evaluation for justification of a program. The choice of a research program is underdetermined by all the facts, which cannot lead a researcher by logic to the correct way of puzzle and problem solving in a domain and no one correct explanatory account. These choices are determined by non-empirical considerations, as the programs are not empirically equivalent, that is that the relevant evidence for the particular program's scope is not shared. What might be within scope of one descriptive and explanatory enterprise might not enter into the other, making their points of contact with nature distinct. The programs are then judged on other merits. For Kuhn, these five characteristics, accuracy, consistency, scope, simplicity, and fruitfulness, are all standard criteria for evaluating the adequacy of a program. If they had not been, I would have devoted far more space to them in my book, for I agree entirely with the traditional view that they play a vital role when scientists must choose between programs. Together with others of much the same sort, they provide the shared basis for program choice. I have replaced Kuhn's phrase of theory choice with program without giving any justification at the moment. Theoretical problems can be divided into methodological and empirical problems. Generally speaking, methodological issues are those that arise out of particular commitments that dictate nature of descriptive and explanatory features of a given program. These commitments cannot be judged on empirical basis. The above-mentioned five values and other like them guide the rational deliberation on these issues, while the eventual degradation of program might be a logical consequence of its internal features. A researcher in the normal course of work has to justify the work based on such criterion. In case of biolinguistics, Noam holds that the explanatory goal of the enterprise must be what the human person acquires, how this is structured, and how it grows and so enables linguistic performance of a competent person. And for this enterprise to be consistent with related successful programs, it must been treated as part of biology and proceed on similar lines. To not do so as a doctrine is a form of dualism that treats study of mind-brain distinct from study of rest of human biology. Like biologists, Noam hold that genetics provides for development of specific organs with specific properties and structures and function within the whole organism, that matures and works according to internal rules, laws of nature, and external stimulus. Like natural scientists, he believes that idealizations and generalizations with considerations of formalization in terms of mathematics that captures the nature of system under study are essential, as the goal of a scientist is not to explain the phenomenon, but to develop theories that explains underlying principles of nature. These and other methodological features shape his explanatory and descriptive enterprise. These are distinct from behaviorist and empiricist dualist methodological commitments in that they postulate powerful general learning mechanism and possibility of boundless learning. For example, infinitely varied and all kinds of associations and grammars, unlike any known features in the biological world. Its explanatory accounts then restricts itself to set of inputs and observable behaviors and does not postulate specific internal mechanisms, other than the above-mentioned general learning mechanism, like conditioning, associationism, etc., contra the genetically given specific systems. They therefore tend to be externalist and statistical in their explanatory goals and choice of descriptive terms, making the enterprise less adequate on these counts and also on count of external consistency. This distinction is not clearly demarcated. Methodological commitments do have some empirical bases. The choice of what are the relevant one and their imports to explanatory goals and description restriction are value-driven. Biolinguistics is based on the empirical consensus that humans are biological systems, and that the genetic and evolutionary developmental programs have been largely successful. Empirical assumptions are the concrete descriptive claims about state of things, that such and such is the case, say a mechanism, within any program. These claims can in principle be fleshed out for empirical testing within the program's assumptions, and therefore can be empirically substantiated, and the results evaluated on rational grounds, usually not affecting the more established or entrenched hardcore parts. This could explain why Noam has focused his criticism more on methodological grounds and not on empirical ones, as these can be easily defended as minor anomalies if the methodological assumptions are taken for granted. This is seen by many as a radical idea that paradigms cannot be criticized or defended primarily on empirical grounds, but acceptable to anyone who has studied any period of scientific history. Empirical assumptions of, say, particular mechanism of learning, etc., can be judged in principle on the basis of descriptive and explanatory adequacy of a particular instantiation of mechanism under question, and of the feasibility of such mechanism in explaining the relevant phenomenon. It goes without saying that all of this is done keeping in mind the relevant evaluations of associated studies within parameters of both or more paradigms. Compared to methodological commitments, researchers are more flexible in giving up particular empirical assumptions about particular the state of things. This happens when tests, thought experiments, or reflection within the program's parameters repeatedly suggest otherwise, and this might leave the program largely intact based on other internal factors. Insubstantial empirical assumptions of a program are those state of things claims that allow easy reformulation of these claims into substantial empirical assumption and claims of another contending program, leaving only the differing terminological and descriptive and explanatory choices of the first program intact. When Quine grants possibility of innate structures of yet unknown characteristics and quality space in acquisition of knowledge, this is vague enough in a particular way to be reformulated as a nativist theory of knowledge acquisition. When core empirical assumptions have become insubstantial, it loses much of its power. This, combined with external inconsistencies, descriptive inadequacies of postulated mechanism, and their non-feasibility, further weakens a program. Substantial empirical assumptions, on the other hand, are those that do not allow such reformulation of particular empirical claim, and are thus substantially distinct. Hume's theory of acquisition of knowledge, for example, details the mechanism of primary and secondary impressions, forming faded impressions that associate by specific rules, is an empirical assumption. Goodman, while studying induction, also maintained substantial distinction, and this led him to absurd results. We can now look, albeit only superficially and briefly, how Noam's views on the mind-body problem can be seen within this schematic. What was the mind-body problem? Emphasizing the historicity of Descartes' mind-body distinction, Desmond Clark writes that when Descartes wrote about matter, the matter in question was a theoretical construct of Cartesian natural philosophy. Whatever corpus or materia may have meant in that system, these terms certainly did not mean the same as matter today, and that his mind-body distinction is not conceptually isomorphic with what is now called the mind-body problem. Descartes and his contemporary physical scientists assumed that the universe was composed of microscopic corpuscles, and that all natural phenomena could be explained in terms of corpuscular shape, size, motion, and interaction. That nest of commitments proved to be both metaphysical and methodological. As metaphysical, it told scientists what sorts of entities the universe did and did not contain. There was only shaped matter in motion. As methodological, it told them what ultimate laws and fundamental explanations must be like. Laws must specify corpuscular motion and interaction, and explanation must reduce any given natural phenomenon to corpuscular action under these laws. But there are features of the world, Descartes noted, namely of intellect and of willed action, broadly the mental substance or things, that do not allow themselves to be formulated in the corpuscular mechanical framework. This led Descartes to think of the scope of the material as being coextensive with those natural phenomena for which we can at least in principle provide a scientific explanation, and to classify whatever lies outside the scope of the latter as immaterial. It may be that mental phenomena are immaterial in both senses. Then, for Descartes, The mind-body problem was a problem of explanatory gap while assuming the adequacy of the given methodological commitment. But after Principia was gradually accepted, and corpuscularism gave way to an explanatory account that could include new and ever-increasing variety of explanations and entities. After the shift from a rigid to relaxed methodological commitment, there was no longer material things or substance from which immaterial things could be compared, and with the collapse of the material, there was no gap to be closed. Rather, there were all sorts of things in the world. Electrical things, chemical things, mental things, etc. The study of how one sort of things interact with other became regular part of scientific effort in mature areas for assimilation and integration. The large part of writing in philosophy journals does not appear to be formal inquiries in logic or anything like critical programs appraisal that Chomsky engages in. But if they are not doing this, any historical work or clarification of pseudo-problems, then what are they engaged in? For example, many thinkers still write about mind-body problem devoid of any historicity and without any roots in natural sciences. This exercise, since the gradual decline in support of naturalism among some philosophers, tacitly assumes metaphysical inquiries outside the bounds of natural science. But a major lesson from Descartes to Newton chapter in history was that a priori speculation devoid of naturalistic research is not fruitful. What kinds of mechanisms and entities there are in the world is described by best available theories. Two kinds of a priori question especially make no sense to Chomsky, those about ontology and realism. And Chomsky's approach to ontological issues is almost identical with Carnap's. This voluntarist orientation remained fundamental. The notion that something beyond the scope of science might actually be the case seemed to Carnap a backdoor to the readmission of traditional prejudices and conformities of all kinds. Certainly we need to make assumptions, he acknowledged. But we can decide on these and spell them out. They are not out there for us to find. On these grounds he deprecated Quine's preoccupation with ontology. It makes no sense to talk about what there is, Carnap said, without specifying the language framework in which this is asserted. Any such claim can only be understood or judged relative to a framework. It makes perfectly good sense to ask, within a framework that includes, say, the Zermelo-Frankel axioms for set theory, whether there are infinite numbers. Such internal questions have determinate answers. But it makes no sense, outside such a framework, to ask just in general whether there are infinite numbers. Not only is there no determinate answer, but there is no way to give such an external question itself any clear meaning. Same remarks and in similar terminology can be found in Noam's interviews and writings. Another kind of question that Noam believes is meaningless is to ask in general, is whether such and such thing is real. Things are real within or a crucial part of a language framework, borrowing Carnap's terminology, depending on the choice of language framework. That is to say, things exists in various senses. For example, Sherlock's hat is real in the fictional universe, so when we choose to talk about things in Conan Doyle's book, the hat exists. If we talk about economical things, the economic crisis in Pakistan is a real thing. In language framework where we are talking about how the natural world works, the things in our best available theories exists. We can only ask whether a thing is real if we are clear about in what sense and language framework are we talking about, and does that framework has this entity in it. This view in Chomsky probably has some connections with pragmatism of later Carnap and Frege's theory of sense, and also the relation between the philosophical attitude associated with this name and the aspects of language use within a community named pragmatism by Mead and Charles Morris. But I cannot proceed in that direction at the moment. A schematic can only help navigate and guide us in our search, but not do the hard work of clear thinking for us. And this schematism, I believe, gives a clear enough picture to better navigate Noam's philosophical writings. Noam's philosophical project is influenced by Carnap's scientific philosophy and is a peculiar kind of therapeutic work. These can most visibly be seen in his criticism of behaviorism, which at first was motivated theoretically, but as the Cold War took hold of the social sciences and intellectuals were eager in assisting in the task of social management, also for moral and political reasons. The image of human nature behaviorism and empiricism presents and justifies is unacceptable to Noam and to every person who values individual deliberation, choice and liberty, As a substantive thesis, these ideas show tendency to be against the free development of capacities and diminish the role of rational common sense of judgment and creative capacities and justify control, managerial, technocratic, statist, corporate, patriarchal, casteist, and other. Humans for Noam and other libertarian socialists are not bound, are undetermined, and seek creative and experimental initiatives taking form of infinite possibilities without coercive in a free associative society. In Social Writings too, a similar schema can be found that might shed light on metaphilosophical, moral and practical consideration of Noam Chomsky that I believe are of considerable value in time of multiple and extreme global crisis.